If you're new or you're visiting with us, we're doing a series right now called Origin Stories. And what we're trying to do in this series is go back to the oldest stories that exist in the Christian, Hebrew, frankly, Muslim canon, and ask, why do these stories exist? And so we've been at this now for a couple weeks, and we've come to what some people would call the end of the prehistory. This is kind of, once we turn the page next week, well, actually not next week, 2 weeks from now, once we turn the page to Abram, we've kind of turned the page into more historical, set in a specific context. These first stories here in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, we often refer to as prehistory. I think I told you a couple weeks ago that some people believe that these stories are a direct critique or riff on Babylonian mythologies and stuff. And so that's where we're at right now. This morning, we're going to talk about the Tower of Babel, which is a bizarre, strange, maybe those are the same words, I guess. Very odd story with not a lot of details. And so we're just going to jump into it because I think there's going to be a lot to say about it. So if you turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 11. Now, historically, in the mythology, people believe that Babel doesn't stand alone, that there's a great leader behind this story. And that great leader is, anybody? Also an album by Green Day. I hear it over here. Nimrod, good. Nimrod, the guy in chapter 10 that I'm going to read about first, is the guy that's leading the charge here at Babel. That's kind of the oral history that goes behind this. So let me read his story, and it starts in chapter 10, verse 8. Cush was the father of Nimrod, who became a mighty warrior on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, and that is why it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. I just think that's funny. The first centers of this kingdom, of his kingdom, were Babylon, Uruk, Akkad, and Calna in Shinar. Remember Shinar, that's going to come back. From that land, he went to Assyria, where he built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Calah, and Resen, which is between Nineveh and Calah, which is the great city. So that's all we know about Nimrod right there. Turn the page to chapter 11. Now, the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. So you remember that detail from Nimrod's story about how he settled in Shinar and he's this great and mighty warrior, this great leader? That's why they've put these two together. So if you start doing any research or any studying about Babel, you're gonna run into Nimrod, and that's why. Oh, I have a picture of him. This is his 8th grade photo. All right. They said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that people were building. The Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so that they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So when I was a kid, the picture I had, let me just give you a little historical background, then I want to hear your thoughts on the text. When I was a kid, that's probably the picture I have in my head from being a kid as Babel. Anybody else? Is that roughly a conical tower with, I think the reason they always drew it that way is because the ramp went around the outside, which is a theory as to how they built the pyramids as well, that there were ramps going around the outside that they eventually took down. And so this is a tower that has ramps going on around it. So that's kind of what I've thought. I learned a couple years ago and then studied more this week that when it comes to the Tower of Babel, some scholars believe that the Jews, when they put this story in the canon, they were thinking about a very specific tower. It wasn't just generically some tower that was built somewhere, but rather they were talking about this particular tower at Entamanaki. This tower, in Babylonian mythology, Babylonian mythology doesn't really say much about where Babylon came from. It just kind of was always there. And the tower at the center of the city was always just kind of there. And then in like 689 BC, I believe, Sennacherib destroys Entamenaki. And then when the Assyrians come to power, and when Nebuchadnezzar specifically comes to power, he rebuilt Entamenaki. And so this is an artist's rendering of what Entamenaki would have looked like. We know it would have looked like this or something like this because they've actually found a tablet with a drawing that kind of lays this out and then descriptions of what it looked like. And so the top blue part is lapis lazuli. Is that right? Is that how you say that? Sweet. Yeah, I just pulled that out of somewhere. I don't know. So that when the Jews told this story about Babel, I'm going to talk a little bit later about they're situated in Babylon. They're thinking about this tower. The original tower was always kind of unfinished until Nebuchadnezzar came and finished the whole thing. So that kind of starts playing into this story about this tower that's unfinished and all of that. So that's kind of the historical context, perhaps, for this story, when they had in mind this tower. This is going to be important later, by the way, is our picture of the tower is going to matter in one of the slides later. So you can see it's basically a Mesopotamian ziggurat, if you remember sixth grade at all. Did everybody do ziggurats in sixth grade? I went to Christian school, so my history was always a little wonky. All right. Sorry. That's a whole nother talk. So when we read the Babel story, tell me, what do you hear? What do you see? What have you thought about what this text means when you've thought about it over the years? Because I know everybody thinks about this story all the time. Eric. Oh, so what does it mean that God scattered? Did he blow them away? I think most people would say the idea that they couldn't understand each other anymore, so that by changing their language, then they naturally just migrated away from each other, and that's the scattering of God. But it is way more fun to think of God like plopping them around. You go to North America. Yeah. Right. The way that verse reads, like, if I let them build this tower, they're going to build an atomic bomb. Which we did, like, it just took like 6,000 years to do. But yeah, there's something there. We're going to come back to that idea a little bit later. Yeah, Ed. They made man-made products, the bricks instead of natural products, stones. What does that mean to you? Oh, the bricks won't last as long as stone. Interesting. So that God's critique of them is that they're not using natural materials, perhaps? Okay, good. I didn't even think to look at all that. I did title the Facebook post today Babbling About Babel, which I thought was fun. Which is where we get babbling. Like that's the idea behind babbling, is that it's just confused nonsense. What were you gonna say? I'm sorry, there was two things going on here. Right. Right. Very good. Thanks. Cause you think that was the original language? Okay. I've been in by the way, this is how arcane my religious upbringing was at times, is I remember a debate once about what language they were actually speaking at Babel, the Hebrew being the predominant opinion, but yeah, I was going for English. Yeah. Oh, that preaches well, doesn't it? The diversity matters. That diversity is good, that maybe what God is doing here is bringing diversity, and that's maybe God isn't punishing them in the end of the story, maybe he's gifting them. That's an idea. I'm going to come back to that. Good. Yeah. Oh, sure. All right. So the language that unites us is love, is what you're saying, even though the other language might be separate. Yeah. Right. There is this weird, like, and we're not going to talk about that at all. So let me pause there for a second. This idea, and this is, again, storytelling, so let's just give it that, that God says to God's self, let us go down and check out what's going on down there, as if somehow God is unaware of what's happening in the creation down there. Like, let's just go for a stroll and see what they're doing. Like, there's that. But then there's also that Trinitarian piece where, who's us? It's one of those first places where we get like, what? Like God's talking to himself and using the royal plural. I don't know, is the royal plural a thing? I just made it up. Yeah. I'm just amazed you're saying something. That is so awesome. I think this is the second time in 10 years. Good. Yeah, so their conception of the multi-storied universe is that we live here and the gods are up there and that hell is down there. And that all gets blown away by Copernicus, obviously, and we have to change our thinking. But that, so the idea of God coming down is very much how they thought of the world, that God was up there somewhere. And so I was also taught a message when I was a kid that this tower-making enterprise that they were after was about them trying to make a tower that could get them to God. That it's similar to the Adam and Eve story about how if we eat the apple, we will have the knowledge that God has. That this story is an echo of that, that if we can just build a tower, we can ascend to the heavens. We can get to where God is. We will be on the throne, not God. That's what this is about, is Nimrod asserting himself as greater than God. That was the sermon I heard when I was a kid. Yeah, Steve. Do you think the city is mentioned positively here or negatively? We'll come back to that. No, I'm not just ignoring you and shutting you off. I'm coming back to that. We're going to talk about city versus agriculture too. All right. So if you've been around here for a while, you've heard me talk about kind of my process. Tuesdays are study day. I don't make very many meetings on Tuesdays. Mostly I get here early. I study until I just kind of run out of energy. And so usually by about 11 o'clock on Tuesday morning, most of the message is starting to firm itself up, and then slides get built later in the week. But at least for study goes, Tuesday's my shutdown study day. And a lot of times coming into a passage, I kind of know where it's going to go before I get there. You know, like a lot of these stories are stories I've read the Bible through a couple times, and I kind of know what's going to happen. This is one, I got to say, on Tuesday morning at 7 o'clock when I started to study, I had no idea where this week was going to go, and it was kind of fun. And then what happened is I was kind of like, I thought I had an idea, and then I started reading, and I got more confused, and I got more confused, and then I got more confused, and finally by about 10:30, 11 on Tuesday, I was super confused, and then just wanted to skip this and teach on something else, and then decided to teach you everything. So, hang on to your hats. All right, so interpretation number one of six, why we need the Babel fish. So what I want to do is I'm going to walk you through various interpretations, six of them to be precise, in a short manner. And I'm going to point at the strengths and weaknesses of each, and then we're going to land on which one's the right one. All right? So that's how we're going to proceed through this. All right? So number one, why we need the Babel fish. This is my historic, like this is the way I was taught growing up. And similar to April, like I grew up believing that this story told us how we got the languages. That's it. That's what this story was about. That's why it was preserved, because I grew up in a Baptist setting where we had a very literal understanding that there was a first human beings, Adam and Eve, and everything descended from these two people. And if everything descends from these two people, they're all talking the same language. In my mind as a kid, it was English. And that eventually, when they got to Babel, then they all got split up. And so that's all I thought the story was about. And it wasn't until maybe this week that I started asking bigger questions. Like, I think in time I thought, like, it's probably not that, but I didn't know what to replace it with. The struggle I have with that is, let me say, like, there's two struggles. One is, this is a really cool, I just saw this for the first, anybody see this? This was going around Facebook a couple weeks ago, and it was like a description of, like, it's a map of where languages come from. That we can, just like we can study the evolution of human beings, we can understand the evolution of language, and we can understand how when this people moved here and separated from this people, this language developed. And I would even argue that this map fits with what the Bible itself is telling us. If we take the scriptures super literally and just go backwards into chapter 10, I want to show you a couple things. Chapter 10, verse 4, the sons of Javan, Elishas, Tarshish, Critters, and the Rodonites. I don't think that's Critters. Kittites, whatever. And then the parentheses in verse 5. From these, the maritime peoples spread out into their territories by their clans and within their nations. What's the next part? Each with its own language. Keep going down. If you get to verse 20. These are the sons of Ham by their clans and languages into their territories and nations. Verse 31, these are the sons of Shem by their class and languages and their territories and nations. These are the clans of Noah's sons according to their lines of descent within their nations. From these, the nations spread out over the earth after the flood. If we take the Bible story pretty literally, what's happening already in chapter 10 is that tribes are beginning to spread out. They're already developing languages. And then the Babel story zooms into one son of a son of a son of a son of a son of Noah, and this Nimrod character and what happens here. And so I don't, most of the scholars I read these days would say that this is not, this is the one theory I'm a little bit dismissive of the six I'm going to share with you this morning, that this story is probably not about that, but it does give us the need for the Babel fish. This is the Babel fish. In case you're not familiar with the Babel fish, let me read its description to you. It feeds on brainwave energy, absorbing all unconscious frequencies and then excreting them telepathically. A matrix formed from the conscious frequencies and nerve signals picked up in the speech centers of the brain. The practical upshot of is which is if you stick one in your ear, you can instantly understand anything said to you in any form of language. So this fish, if you stick this fish in your ear, you can understand everything everybody's saying to you, says the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It looks exactly like this. Actually, there's a website, you know. You guys know that there's a website called Babelfish that you can go type in anything and it'll translate it. And do you know that it's a reference to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy referring to the Tower of Babel? So meta, I love it. All right, so theory number two, I got to keep moving. God bless the farmland theory. This goes to what Steve was just saying. Is that somewhere in the telling of this story, scholars believe that there's this thing rose up about who does God prefer more? Does God prefer the farmers and agriculture, or does God prefer urbanization? And that this story at some point served to say that what? God prefers whom? The farmers, right? And we still have a little bit of this in our culture, right? We have this like nostalgia and this like thought about farmers are closer to the land. There's something pure and holy about being a farmer. Where's Joel? I'm looking for Joel to give him props. He's not in here. Oh, he's in the hallway. Hey, Joel, props. See if he sticks his head in. But this idea, remember Cain and Abel? One of the things I said that some people have like looked at Cain and Abel and said, this is class warfare about the sheep herders versus the vegetables. The same kind of thing might be happening here, and that some people say the reason this story existed in Israel's history is that it was confirming and applauding the efforts of the farmers and the goodness and that farming is better. In our history, actually, I think it's true to say of all of human history, most people have been in agricultural settings. And it's only been in the last century or so, in America at least, that you've had a crossover. There's Joel. I was just saying good things about farmers, and I was giving you props. All right, so this story was that. So that people could say, like, distrust what happens in the city. And you can hear some of this happen still in our own language, right? In our own culture, where the farm is where we go for purity and farmers are all good, except when they're driving on the road this time of year. And then no bitterness at all. But somehow the cities are cesspools. And you can think about even American literature, how much that theme gets picked up throughout history. So that would have been a theme to ancient peoples. And so there's a theory that part of the interpretation of this passage has to do with God bless the farmland theory. Next slide. Interpretation way number three. Way to go, you stupid Babylonians hypothesis. All right, let me just go real quickly on this one. So to catch you up, here's how we believe Hebrew scriptures were formed. People started telling stories. Sharing stories around campfires at night, people told stories and they just got told over and over and over and over again. And at some point, rabbis gathered and said, when we want to tell our story, what's in and what's out? What are our actual stories and what are not? And the place in which they did that was Babylon. It was in the Babylonian captivity after being deported by Nebuchadnezzar in 586 BC. They were in Babylon, and it was in Babylon that they started saying, like, who are we and what's our story? And they started assembling scriptures. And so one of the things that they're trying to do with these stories is to explain the world as they know it. And if you're living in captivity in Babylon, who's the bad guys? Okay, this isn't hard. If you've been deported to Babylon by the Babylonians, who are the bad guys? The Babylonians. Just like when I was a kid, every show on TV, the bad guys were who? The Russians, right? Like, come on, Air Hawk, Russians. The A-Team, it was always the communists and the Russians. Like, it was always the communists and the Russians that were the enemies, right? And so they were doing that kind of thing here. That the reason some of these stories existed is to say, way to go, Babylonians. We all had one language. Everything was good. And then the Babylonians go and start building towers. And so they ruined everything. And I haven't done this a lot, but throughout these first 11 stories, this is happening a lot, especially in these genealogies. This is why these people are the way they are. This is why the Moabites are the way they are. This is why the Philistines are the way they are. This is why all these groups are the way they are, because they've got bad roots. And this is why the Babylonians are evil, is because they've got bad roots. One of the things that's interesting is Israel doesn't really tell their story in these first chapters about Egypt at all. Now, think about how big of a role Egypt plays in their story and will play in their story. But these first 11 stories, there's nothing referring Egypt. It's all about Mesopotamia. It's all about Babylon. And so this story might be, some people say, a thing to say, hey, the Babylonians are evil. Interpretation number four, the Glenn Beck gospel. This is the first time at Imago Dei Church that I've quoted Glenn Beck as part of my sermon research. And I actually did spend 25 minutes watching Glenn Beck to get here. And it's not all half-cocked, all right? I promise you, there's good stuff here. So just hang on. It's so funny right now looking across the room. I see some people smiling. I see people frowning and shaking their heads. That was polarizing. So several years ago, Glenn Beck had on his show this guy, Rabbi Daniel Lavin, and they were talking specifically about the Babel story. So let me hit a couple other points. Now, let me say before I get into this is that these other things I've said so far have been kind of meta up here. This is the first one of the six that really starts to get down into the weeds and the details of the story, and I really like that. Like, they start getting into the weeds of the story. So let's get into some of the details of the story, because the first thing I noticed when I was doing my... So when I study, the first thing I do is I just read the passage and I start making my own notes. And I kind of get to where, like, I think what it's saying. And then I go to commentaries and read there, and then I go to the interwebs because... In the words of Abraham Lincoln, you can't trust everything you find on the internet. And so I do that last. So what they say, what Rabbi Lavin says and Glenn Beck talk about, is they talk a lot about these three ideas of bricks, stones, and mortar. And a little bit to Ed's point, it was funny listening to you all, by the way, you hit a lot of these things. Ed's point was that stones are a natural material. Now describe a stone to me. What size is a stone? Any size. And what color is a stone? Any color. And what shape is a stone? Whatever you want. I could have hundreds of things up here that looked kind of alike, but not really, and you would call all of them stones. But there's only one thing I could put on the stage that would look like a brick, right? Like, you would know exactly what a brick looks like. It has a, it's a rectangle, it's a, you know, a thing. And so this interpretation, and by the way, it's not just this one rabbi. This is in a historical setting of rabbis say that part of what this story is it's a metaphor for human beings, that we were created to be stones. We were created to have a purpose, a unique purpose in the world. And that the story here of what's happening is that the bricks represent uniformity and conformity. And that part of what's happening here is they're giving up their unique, God-given uniqueness in order to just conform to what everybody else wants. Now, because Glenn Beck is super political, this is about socialism, obviously. That the bricks are socialism and the stones are, I don't know, libertarianism, freedom, go be who you want to be. Like, you don't subject to anybody. And so it goes down that pathway. And then it takes a little bit of a turn when they start talking about mortar. And the rabbi says, and I'm just going to tell you up front, I don't think I agree with this mostly. The rabbi says mortar, the Hebrew word, the root of the Hebrew word for mortar, Hebrew doesn't have vowels, it only has consonants. And the root of the Hebrew word for mortar is MTR. And, oh, the English word is MTR. So, by the way, this is a total fallacy in translation, because English words are constructed on a completely different alphabet, and it's just coincidence, because there's lots of Hebrew words that when you translate them to English, they don't have the same roots, it doesn't matter. And then the same letters show up in materialism, so therefore, the mortar that holds the socialists together is materialism. Which I'm not really actually sure that works with socialists anyway. But here's what I gotta say. I totally disagree with how he gets there, but I love what he preaches at this point, right? So Glenn Beck at this point, and I don't really know what he's about, except to say that he then at that point talks about how materialism is the glue that holds all this, somehow it turned into the one world government. Socialism turned into the one world government. That materialism is the glue that holds the one world government together. And as stones made by God, we're supposed to reject that. Which I kind of like a whole sermon rejecting materialism. That's great. I just don't know that this is the way to get there, all right? So that's where it starts. There's pieces there that are really good. And then this piece is brilliant. He points out that in the passage doesn't tell us that God is angry or that the scattering and the languages is anything related to punishment. Who said this earlier? I pointed to somebody and said, maybe it's a gift. That this is perhaps a gift. That what God is doing, so think about the story we told last week about the flood, and God promised that even though human beings are evil, I will not do that kind of thing ever again. That this is a story then about people doing evil, whatever you think about the bricks, stones, mortar, socialism, one world government, all that, but people doing evil and God withholding his hand, and instead of smiting them and punishing them, he graciously, kindly scatters them so that they can get back to the story of Genesis 1, scatter and be fruitful and multiply. That's what God is doing here, is he's gently course correcting them back onto the right pathway, which is kind of a cool story, right? Like I actually, at this point, 20 minutes into Glenn Beck, I was like, well, hey, I kind of like that. That seems to resonate with me. And then one last thing Glenn Beck says, and this is where he went completely off the rails. The EU Parliament building looks like an artistic rendering of Babel. I mean, duh, just go to the next slide. It's so obvious. I am not kidding. He put this on the screen and compared the two buildings for a while. I was like, you're comparing a drawing to an actual, what? And how the EU is a one world government like Nimrod. And I don't know, it got real weird after that. And then I stopped. All right. The Illuminati, yes. somehow the Illuminati was part of that. I don't know, really. All right, interpretation number 5. Let's keep moving. It's the first iPhone. This was actually the story that I was starting on. This came to me for the first time. I read it probably a year or two by Rob Bell. And this is the one I was going to preach today. And then I'll give you a little piece, and then we'll move on to something else. So Rob Bell also goes to the brick and the mortar and the stone and really focuses in on there. And then he goes backwards, and I'll explain that in just a second. But he says this, is that when we think about bricks and or stones and bricks, think about building with each of those. I want you to think about, if I brought up a bunch of stones and they were ranging in size here, and I said, build something, how easy is that to do? It's super hard. It's super hard to get stones to sit on top of each other. Have you ever been camping or somewhere where people like just pile stones up in creek beds, which is, I'm sure they have a name for this sport. But it's really hard to do, to get stones to balance right, to fit right and all that stuff. And so you're really limited as to what kind of tower you can build when you're building out of stone. But when you build out of brick, how high can you go? You can go way higher. And so what Rob Bell says is that part of what's happening in this passage, at least, is that this is a story about what happens when a ruler like Nimrod gets hold of a technology that we don't have yet. And how do you feel when a ruler like Nimrod gets a new technology? And if you're not tracking yet, how do you feel when Kim Jong-il gets his hands on a new technology? How do you all feel? And what does that cause in us? And then that the reason this story exists is because it has something about how we deal with new technologies. Rob Bell then ties that back to the idea of Nimrod. Nimrod isn't just building a city. He's building many cities, and we call that what? An empire. Nimrod is an empire builder. And so what Rob says is it's about technology and how we use technology and then how we're using technologies to build empires. I want to read you a quote from his book, What is the Bible, which is one of our Sunday school classes that start this morning after this. We have tremendous power and ability as humans. We can invent things and build things and dream things up and then make them. It's extraordinary, and it's to be celebrated and enjoyed. Say it with me now. HD flat screen, Chipotle, Almond surfboards, anything made by Apple, Rickenbacker guitars. I could go on and so could you. We also have the tremendous capacity to use our energies and minds and power and abilities to further our own purposes through greed and empire building at the expense of those around us, making the world less and less of a peaceful place where everybody is thriving. That preaches, doesn't it? Like this thing has so much power in my hand, and so at a personal level, what am I doing with this? is this becoming an instrument in my hands to lead to a more peaceful world? Or is it becoming an instrument in my hands to do more about Charlie and less good for the world? Or just name the technology. Your car, your house, your everything that you everything like that. Our culture is so technological and we're moving so fast and we can do so much good with it, right? Like if you get cancer, you've never wanted to be alive at a time in our human history where you get cancer as you are right now. Really any kind of sickness. You watch old TV shows, old timey shows. If you're sick, you're so happy to be alive right now because you're okay, mostly. And yet we're also the people, and let's just talk about empires. We are the only people in the human history that has dropped an atomic bomb on people. And we did it twice. And our narrative is that we're the good guys. And so this story has something to say to us as individuals, but it has something to say to us as Americans and as citizens of the world. And how do we handle our technologies? And what does it mean to have a technology? And how do we use it? Interpretation number six. And this is the last one, is that Babel is an ideological critique. This one ties some pieces of several others, and these are all kind of overlapping, some of them in various places and forms. This one is this idea, that the people here, he goes to that Glenn Beck idea where they're not being judged, they're not being punished, but rather the people here are not judged for building a tower or for trying to reach the heavens. They are judged for building a city and uniting under one language, for trying to avoid being scattered. The desire to reach to the heavens reflects a desire for domination on earth. And that when this story was written or assembled in Babylon, it was a critique of the Babylonian idea that said we are awesome because we are Babylonians and we can build great cities and we are going to dominate and we're going to build more cities. It was a critique of that culture and a turn back to, hey, we're supposed to be the image bearers. We're supposed to be the ones that tend for the creation. We're supposed to do good in the creation. We're supposed to do good, not harm. And we're supposed to represent God. So my question this morning then is, as I finish up, is what's the real interpretation? No, I'm asking, what's the real interpretation? Votes. Which one do you like the best? Let's just start. One, two. Wait, what was two? Oh, the farmers. Number two, number three, which was, the stupid Babylonians. Number four, the Glenn Beck narrative. Number five, you're all going to go with Rob Bell. Number six. So between five and six, here's mine. Here's what I think is real. We have no idea. It was a really great study day, by the way. I studied for several hours and got to a spot of, well, I don't know. Beats me. I promised you at the beginning of the series that every week I would explain to you why these stories existed, why they hang on to them, and then how they're relevant to today. And I'm not sure. So let me say a couple things about that. One is, even if I'm not sure about those, for me, in at least two, three maybe of the six I talked about, I could find something relevant to me. How about you? Somehow this story says something to us here and now, even though this story is like 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years old. That we can continue to talk and we can continue to argue. And I hope somebody goes home. I hope spouses go home today and like, I like number five. No, I like number two. And you argue all the way home about it. But, and that somehow that arguing about it helps you to live differently. That somehow you go home and you think like, oh man, I need to think about how I use my technologies. And your spouse is like, I think that's stupid. I hope you don't say that. But I think it's about how I think about me being a unique individual and not just conforming to what everybody else wants me to do. I hope people go home. I hope small groups and friends sit down because that's what people have been doing for thousands of years with stories like these. And that part of our growth in spirituality, I believe, is to come to places where we can say, I don't know. And it's okay that I don't. I don't have to have it figured out. I don't have to know exactly what it is. I don't have to have an opinion. I keep moving forward. This is a quote from a book called Bitten by a Camel by a guy who was literally bitten by a camel. I'm spoiling his story, but literally he was bitten by a camel on Mount Sinai in a religious pilgrimage where he was trying to really connect with God, and then a camel bit him, and he punched it in the face. And that's a spiritual metaphor. He didn't punch it. I thought he punched it. What'd he do? Oh, he was getting ready to punch it. And then they like, oh yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, he was getting ready to punch the camel. Then the camel let go and spit at him. That was the end of the story, yes. He's done this interview several times, and I've heard him speak several times. And it's pretty funny because he's like, here I was trying to connect to God on Mount Sinai, and what I got from it was bitten and spit on by a camel. Thanks God. And so his book is called Leaving Church, Finding God, and it's really, I'm reading it tomorrow. Jennifer read it in one day this week and loved it, and I read it. I listened to him on Rob Bell's podcast. But he says this. Oh, let me set this up. He was talking to a rabbi friend in Israel, and he asked the guy about, like, where do you go? What do Jews believe about where you go when you die? And the rabbi was saying, like, that's not a concern for us. That's just not a part of anything that we ever think, talk, or write about. It's just not, he's like, that's an American question, really? And a newer American question in the history of theology? It's just not what people have always been concerned with. But he says then, it is deeply spiritual to say I'm not sure. It is holy to say I don't really care. It is downright prophetic to say it's not an important question. So really, Babel? I'm not sure. I don't really care which one you land on. I really don't think it's that important of a question. What I think is important when we encounter these texts, because then some people say, like, then what's the point in Bible study at all? What's the point of all of this? Why did you just spend 50 minutes up here talking to us to get to the end and tell us that you don't know? Like, I could have stayed home and watched football or ran the whiskey daddle or whatever. You could have done lots of other things. I was listening this week to another podcast with Mike McCarg on Peter Enns' podcast, and if those names don't mean anything to you, that's fine. And he was talking about this idea that oftentimes in religious circles, what keeps us together, like any group identity, you need something that keeps you all together. Like if you're a Cubs fan, it's obvious. Like that's what keeps us all together is we're Cubs fans, and we're going to keep rooting for them, win, lose, or draw. You don't really draw. But win or lose, like that's what keeps us together. I probably don't vote the same way as a lot of other Cubs fans, and I don't like think the same way as lots of other Cubs fans, but when it comes to rooting for the Cubs, we know what we're about, right? We're there to root for the Cubs, and I don't really care. What happens often is in religious institutions, we get down into the arcane, and so like, what's your view of Babel can become this thing where it's like, oh, you don't agree with me? Well, then I have to go start a new church, the First Church of Babel. Oh, that would be a terrible name for a church. We're the church where God comes down and scatters us. And I was listening to him say that what bonds us together and the joy of this kind of a story is the pursuit itself, the discussion itself, the intent to mine it for meaning and to ask the question about what does this have to do with my life? That to me is the glue at Imago Dei Church, not what you arrive at. Not what conclusion you hold or opinion you hold, or you might feel really strongly about one of those things I put on the screen today. You might be a serious Glenn Beck fan, like if Glenn Beck said it, that's what I believe, and that's fine. And you might be a Rob Bell person. You can't believe that I didn't just endorse Rob Bell's view 100%. Or you might be a farmer. And a part of what this thing is, I think that we put a lot of pressure on people sometimes in religious circles that you have to have it all figured out. You have to know what you believe so you can defend it. And that stories like this bring me back to the space of saying, I don't know what I don't. And yet I know that I've thought about this story a lot this week. I know that when Rob Bell talked about this story, the first time I heard him talk about it, I think I was in LA when I heard him talk about that idea of it's a new technology in the hands of an empire builder. Boy, that resonated with me for quite a while. And I had to sit with that and think about that. And even if that's not what I think the story is actually doing here, boy, that playing with that idea, that's helping me grow. That's helping me move somewhere. And so this morning, that's what I hope you walk away from this. I hope that when you go home today, there's a part of you that you have a great discussion about which one you think it is and which one matters to you and why. And maybe that's what you should do is when you're driving home or talking to a friend later in the week or whatever, you should ask each other, like, which one of those really resonated with you and why? Why do you think it is the way it is? And then at another level, to give some of you permission that maybe you've never been given in your religious upbringing to say, I don't know. And figuring it out isn't the most important thing. Let's pray. God, thank you for a gorgeous, gorgeous day outside and the possibilities for this afternoon to do whatever it is that you've put in us to do. There's a part of me that's thankful for stories that we can't figure out because it reminds us of what an enormous task this is to try to explain things that are just sometimes beyond explanation and we just don't know. And so help this story be as a reminder to us to maintain our humility and to also at the same time drive us to keep growing and to keep studying and to keep discussing and to keep learning and to keep pursuing. And help us to be a church where we make lots of space for each other in that process, whether we're people that really want to talk about this or we're people that say, it doesn't really matter to me, that we just keep making space for each other in this pursuit. In your name I pray, amen.